All right.
Oh, we also got to shoot.
Welcome back, everybody. I think we're going to get started. Welcome back, everybody, and thank you for coming today. We're going to hear two GAMC proposals today, one from Representative Murphy, and if you can head to the table if you want, and then Representative Dean will present his legislation as well. And I do want to acknowledge all the work that has gone into putting these proposals together over the interim, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours of work by people to come up with a solution to this problem. And I want to thank everybody for that. And we're going to be meeting, you know, till about 4:15, but we're going to want to try to move things along relatively quickly, you know, for each testifier so that we can make sure we have enough time for discussion and get done on time. So with that, we have a couple of pieces of business. The committee procedures are in every member's folder. If you're interested and want to review that, you can take a look at that. We do need to approve minutes from our last hearings in 2009 and our interim hearings. So Representative Huntley will move the minutes from April 2nd, 2009, May 1st, 2009, May 5th, 2009, August 10th, 2009, October 5th, 2009, November 4th, 2009, December 14th, 2009, and January 19th, 2010. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Murphy.
Representative Speaker. Mr. Chair.
Can I do one more piece of business? Sorry. We do have a couple of new people with us this year. Laura Sales is the new DFL researcher, so just everybody knows her. And then our pages are Brandon Wurzinger, if you want to wave if you're around. There we go. And Susie Murtha. Is that right? Yes. Okay. Welcome. All right. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 2680 for consideration, and I think it goes to Finance, and then on to Health and Human Services Finance. And I'm a little rusty on making my motions.
All right. So the motion is that 2680 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everybody. I want to begin by thanking a lot of people. I want to thank our staff, Dan Pollack. I know he's in the room. Kate Prusak, Laura Sales, and Randy Chun, who have been working along with a lot of people. From the start of the summer and till now to come up with a draft proposal that is before you. I want to thank the members of the committee with whom I've been working, Tom Huntley and Paul Thiessen, Maria Root and Diane Loeffler, and I'd like to give special thanks and attention to Representative Matt Dean as we've been working to trying to find some common ground on the proposals that you will hear today. I would like to thank the staff of the Department of Human Services and the Commissioner Ludeman, for continuing to work with us and help us understand the many factors in this proposal and how they work, so that we can bring to you a bill that will be scored by the Department of Human Services with a fiscal note, and we can get going at the start of the session with this proposal and move it through to the governor's desk early in the legislative session. And finally, I'd like to thank the GAMC Alliance. I know there are multiple coalitions and alliances that have been working all summer on this proposal to help us in Minnesota find a path to a solution, and that has been my goal from the start. I think our goal from the start is to find a solution that we can get signed into law during this legislative session. And so I just want to begin there by thanking so many people who have done so much work to get us to this point.
Representative Murphy, before, just one more announcement, sorry. There is, if people are interested, there is overflow seating in room 10, which is down on G, is that right? Okay. People are interested, or if you have a seat next to you that's open and want to raise your hand so people can fit in, we can do that too. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had an informational hearing in December where we introduced a proposed bill, And before you is legislation that has been, tweaked, but the basic frame of this legislation is the same. We proposed a promising mental health care delivery reform. We've worked with the Department of Human Services on that. It's intended to reduce hospitalizations and the length of stay for those with persistent mental illness. We know that's one of the cost drivers in DAMC. It's based on an East Metro pilot that's already demonstrated savings by providing rapid access to psychiatric care and psychiatric consultation in aiding discharge. DHS has predicted a modest savings for this proposal, and we'll see that in the fiscal note in the Finance Committee. We have stepped away from the idea of an accountable care organization in this legislation that was introduced in the first proposal. We did that because accountable care organizations are the subject of a lot of discussion in the federal legislation, and we felt it would be good for us to focus our efforts on the elements of an accountable care organization that are important for this population, and that is making sure we're doing intense care coordination, thinking about both health care and the social service needs of this population. And so we've rested on a county-based coordinated care option, a county and provider option to provide care for a defined population for a fixed appropriation. That is sort of a skinny back version of an accountable care organization because we're not necessarily looking at outcomes, but I think the care delivery and the focus on helping a population with high needs, keeping them as healthy as we can and out of the hospital, is the primary idea behind that, and that is in the bill. We have listened carefully to county organizations on the county share provision that was introduced in the first bill. We've met with MAXA and AMC and the third county organization. We've met with them all. They have a philosophical opposition to the idea of a 10% county share. They believe we're going back on a deal that was made long ago, and they've asked that we consider instead a cut to the county block grants or a cut to county program aid. Because this is a health care proposal and not a tax proposal, we are suggesting, or we have in our bill now, a cut to the county CSSA grants and account to county mental health, and I know the counties are going to come up and share their thinking about that. They don't love that. I don't love that, but we're keeping the cuts and the revenue in health care in this proposal so that we keep this as a health care bill. This is a 16-month temporary proposal. I'm sorry, I'm so nervous today. We propose an increase in the MA hospital and HMO surcharges to capture federal funds, and we capture about $75 million in federal funds to finance this proposal. We are already using those financing mechanisms of an HMO and MA surcharge, and we're just growing those a little bit for the 16 months to be able to fund this proposal. We're also able to capture some disproportionate share money, and we can maintain the drug rebate money that we're already experiencing or using in the DAMC program. And those are the primary sources of funding. The county cut that produces about $29 million, the surcharges, the drug rebate, and the disproportionate share. There's been a tremendous amount of work done by the Hospital Association, and they're going to be up to talk to us in a little while. They've been working on the MA surcharge and the repayment formula, and that work is ongoing, and I really want to underscore that part. The MA surcharges are challenging because they're very inflexible and they show really no preference in terms of political party or geography. And when you look at the formula or the spreadsheet that's in your packet today, you'll see that there are hospitals that do well under this formula and hospitals that don't do so well under this formula, and they're in DFL and Republican districts, and they're small and large hospitals, and they're urban and rural hospitals. I met with the hospitals this morning, and they will continue to work. They have a couple of more ideas that they can do with this formula to try and flatten it out a little bit more to make it as equitable as they can. And I think we'll have those ideas before the Finance Committee, Representative Huntley's committee on Tuesday. And you guys all have the chart, I think, that shows, and I can see you're looking at it. Great. Okay. The providers caring for medical assistance patients, so those hospitals that have a high penetration of medical assistance enrollees, will see a rate increase. That's a result of using the MA surcharge. So we're going to take the money from the hospitals, we're going to match it with some federal money, and then we increase the rate in medical assistance. So those hospitals that see a lot of medical assistance do see an increase in this legislation. It is a feature of the surcharge, and those caring for a high penetration of general assistance medical care enrollees see a deep rate cut. One of the reasons that the physicians aren't happy with our proposal, because we are suggesting a significant rate cut for providers in DAMC, and that's because we're spending a lot less money on this proposal than we have on DAMC in the past. As predicted, as we talked about in December, this proposal is less than lovely. We're asking a lot of the provider community. However, the proposal significantly reduces the cost of DAMC, and we fund it within the healthcare budget, which is an important cost containment feature. If enacted, we will reduce the current deficit by $160 million. We shelter property tax and health insurance premium payers from the cost shifts of significant uncompensated care. And that's not just in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. 4% of the original DAMC program payment went to Anoka County, 3% to Dakota County, 2% to Olmsted County, Stearns and Beltrami County, and millions went to Washington, Wright, Itasca, Blue Earth, and Becker's counties. Every 1% of DAMC program represented about $4 million in funding to doctors, hospitals, and clinics in these counties. Most importantly, we extend coverage for the poorest and sickest Minnesotans, and we keep our safety net intact. I'm absolutely certain that there will be changes to this proposal and appreciate the continued openness to successful passage early in the session. We're going to press forward with this proposal as a standalone proposal in the next couple of weeks in order to present it to this governor in a form that he can sign into law, and I hope you'll join me in shaping the proposal in the weeks ahead. I have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right.
It's the A28.
Now, Mr. Murphy moves that the RC-A28 amendment be adopted. Is this a... Well, you might describe the amendment.
It's a lot of technical changes. We removed the section that provides for necessary psychiatric prescriptions and for people who are unable to attain them on their own, and we're doing that because it's too expensive and we can't afford it. We are changing the county-based purchasing surcharge from 3.4% to 4% so that they're equal with the HMOs to comply with federal law. We're changing the date. The date had been changed from March implementation to April implementation after the governor announced that there was a little bit more money to extend the current DAMC program. We decided it would be more fiscally prudent to keep the date in March so that if we're able to successfully pass that, the money that would be going into the current DAMC program could be used for other purposes, either for this program or for deficit reduction. So we've kept the dates the same.
Any discussion? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just got the large version of this. So can you tell me, Representative Murphy, where the grant language is compared to the 10% share language?
It is at the back of the bill.
Is this on the amendment or the... Okay.
Yes, that is that we take the county share out. And that is, Randy, is that line, is it 4.6?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Adler, it's section 32 of the amendment. It's the reductions in the county grant.
Say that again.
It would be section 32 on page 5 of the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
I'd just like to talk about that section for a second. I tried to catch up to Murphy, and I've just been too busy in general, and suddenly here we are voting on an amendment. and my comments won't surprise you. I think that I'm fully supportive of moving this bill along in whatever form it turns into today towards some kind of resolution to serve these people, the ones that have the needs and all that. I serve some of my clinic, and I understand very well their needs, and I think they've made a good effort to inform us of the challenges that they face. However, I want to caution you and the members of the committee and those who are asking for relief under this bill that you might cause some harm you didn't know about by getting 10% of the money from the counties. I talked to my county this morning. I've been talking to them all along, and Anoka County is a pretty gracious county. They're going to try to, they have a strong interest in serving this population. They already do. They push them into transitional Minnesota care without any harm. As a matter of fact, I think some 1,200 people have gone off the general assistance rolls into the transitional Minnesota care role, And no one has complained about that. That's the good news part. And so current law for people who can get into Minnesota Care might actually solve a great deal of the people's needs, of the people themselves. As we start taking a share from the county of this magnitude, this would actually have them dip into their already adopted budgets and lay off some staff. And ironically, some members of locals who are of the same labor groups that are supporting this group will find themselves laid off at the county level. And some of the services that we take for granted at the county level that we like for other groups of people will be undone. And I realize you don't like this any better than the other 10% thing. The 10% share at least gives the county the flexibility to take it out of snow plowing, or they could paint something less often, or they could cut their commissioners' bonuses, or salaries, and they'd have flexibility. And some actually gave themselves raises, but not in my county. But that's a perilous place to go. And I don't have a motion to strip this out of your amendment. I decided what I should do, but I thought I just would talk about it. But I think this is a bad idea. And the bill needs to get out today, it needs to move along, and all of that. And I have other comments about other parts of the bill, not of this amendment, but I hope that as we go forward with this project, that we don't make things worse for some of the other people that have needs just as grave as the people we're serving here. And so that's my comment, and I have no motion, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And I think, when I talked about this provision in December, I said I didn't love it, and I don't love this one either. We're trying to work with the counties. They've worked really hard to try and understand what their costs will be, and I think they have a pretty good appreciation of their costs, with the exception of incarceration costs and the law enforcement costs at both the county and the city level when so many people lose access to the medications. So I think that they understand that they're going to incur some costs. They're trying to work with us to try and find a way to balance that and pay for the care for the population so they don't incur those costs. And I would love your ideas. They brought this idea to us, not my favorite idea. They really don't like the 10% county share. They like that less than this, and that's a philosophical issue for them. So I would love your help in trying to solve this part.
Representative Abler.
And thank you. I'm in the work to make this better. Both my feet are in the water, and we're getting wet here. It's going to be quite a session on many topics. But I want to remind the author and members here that little counties don't have much of a voice here. And having talked to some members who represent little counties, maybe they pay dues to be part of the organizations, but the county groups have a challenge. They have to actually represent 87 counties, and they don't agree sometimes on anything. And they have to give a county view, and so it's more generic. I know for a fact that some little counties are going to quit doing these social service grants. They're just going to stop doing that function. And so even though a big county like Hennepin or Anoka could kind of shift a bit and find some way to do the services, that just because the counties, in the name of two or four lobbyists, tell us that they're fine, I tell this only to keep our ears open, and when you get a call from some person from outstate Minnesota representing their board, that we remember them too, because they don't even know we're doing this today. They know we're in session, and they're listserv, they're busy, they're doing other things, but they're very lean staffs already. So anyway, that's my thought. Thank you.
Yeah, and the counties will be, or the county association will be testifying later, so we can have that discussion then too.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the amendment? Discussion to the amendment. All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. There's a couple other amendments here. Are those, do we know what those are? Oh, these are yours, Jim?
Oh, yes. Do you want to do those now?
If you want to, it was better to wait. We can. Why don't we have the testimony and do those after?
Whenever you like.
That's fine. Okay.
All right.
Is that all you have?
That is what I have.
Okay. And we will have time for discussion after we have testimony. So why don't we start with that?
All right.
So, Mr. Do you want to introduce them? Representative Murphy?
And Caleb.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome to the committee. So, and please, if you can identify yourself for the record as you see fit. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Gary Goffel.
Could you lean in a little bit more to that? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry about that. My name is Gary Goffel. I appreciate you listening to why I am asking you for the support of this legislation, preserving health coverage for people like me. I was born in Wydena, Minnesota, and eventually moved from the farm to South St. Paul. After high school, I had a low draft number for Vietnam, so I enlisted and spent the summer working on my grandparents' farm. I then went to Fort Sam Houston, where I became a rifle expert and a medic. I was in an ambulance company of the 7th Brigade, which is a medical unit, and there was a lot of little things that we learned. Like an E-10 can be your best friend or your enemy's worst nightmare. You could use it as a weapon or use it as a tracheotomy or a splice for an artery. Medic was a prize catch for the Vietnamese because they could make you work on their guys at the expense of our soldiers. Now, for example, you ever saw the movie MASH? We were the ambulances for that company. Later years, I did some work at the VA hospital for 7 years and managed in restaurants for 15. In August of 2008, I was living in Invergrove Heights, heading to work at Mystic Lake, where I'd worked security for 9 years. A deer entered the road on 35E. An assault accident in my SUV caused back injury and headache. I lost my job in fall of 2008. I began using GM in October of 2008 to address my injuries. This is a godsend as I waited for veterans' benefits to kick in. I was sharing an apartment with and rent with my son until last year. My son was laid off as a cook and National Guard. He entered the military full time. When he left, I couldn't afford the rent, and so I lost my housing. I lived with a friend for a few months, but had not had stable housing for almost a year. I am hoping to get a housing help from the VA, but that hasn't happened yet. For some, GA MCA was a bridge until federal support came, but that can take years. I'm representing other veterans that couldn't be here who need this bill passed to allow access when it's most needed. And I'd only made one sacrifice, protect vulnerable by serving our country. I've made two. See, this morning, my son leaves for Afghanistan in the 101st Airborne Division. Thank you for seeing where the sacrifices must be made to protect our vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Caleb. This is not easy for me, but it is important for me to tell you why it's critical that you pass this legislation today. A lot of attention is paid to returning soldiers from Iraq, but after returning home, ceremonies, another battle can begin. I was born in Minneapolis. I'm Native American, a member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. I grew up in Prior Lake, but don't like to think about growing up because the fact that it was really difficult. I joined the National Guard at 18. I am now 26. I was 11 Bravo and E1. I was proud of the fact that I did very well in the acute aptitude vocational battery test. I also scored almost perfect 300 in the Army physical fitness test, which I was also proud of. I chose infantry because I wanted to be on the front line. In bayonet training, we learned things like kill, kill, kill with cold blue steel. In my first tour in Iraq, I was in the Red Bull Division, the one mentioned in the Star Tribune and Pioneer Press today. First Brigade Combat Team. As the longest serving unit in Operation Iraqi Freedom, I ended up being there 1 year and 6 months after the tour was extended. I came home, my mother passed away. I was honorably discharged a short time later. I enlisted in regular army. I was 39 Bravo, military police officer. We deployed to Baghdad for another 12 months. The war was very difficult for me and everybody. I saw things people, you know, shouldn't see. In more recent times, I started using GAMC to help me with my health problems that were a result of the war and trauma I've been through. Having it meant I had my three medicines a day. Also, I unfortunately developed a chronic disease which requires a special diet. It's been hard for me to take help, but easy access has meant I did. When a person doesn't have housing, survival skills kick in. Sleeping on university campuses or outside is sometimes the last resort. The Army taught me how to set up camp, so when those heavy rains came at the end of November, I stayed dry. My main concern being that Stephen King book that I had spent $35 on, it was under the dome. You know, I was concerned it didn't get wet. It's harder, so in winter, for some, the Stone Arch Bridge, for others, it's a roof. I was a good soldier. There are a lot of people who just kind of flunk out of it. It was difficult. I imagine this is difficult for you in a different way. We both know what it's like to serve our country and make decisions we may not agree with in order to protect Americans. Maybe you can overcome your despair about what you do by knowing that you're helping us overcome our own. And thank you for supporting this legislation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Baylor.
Before they go, can I ask them a question?
Well, I think we're going to...
For the witness.
I think we're going to not do that.
Karen, who do you have? Oh, do you want? Can we ask? Go ahead, Representative Abler.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for serving, but if you don't answer anything I want to ask you, you don't have to answer anything. But I thank you very much for coming forward, and it's good to hear what you have to say. It's bad, but it's helpful for us. So thank you. But I do have a question for either one of you. I'm curious, where's the VA in helping you and not general assistance? And are you hooked into a clinic, do you have a local clinic that you could care at? Those are my two questions. You can pick either or none if you want to answer them.
Well, for me, my name's Gary Dunkel, and I was staying at the Harbor Lake Salvation Army, and I've used their clinic several times for back pain and for headaches. And without this program, I don't know where I would have been. Thank you.
For myself, personally, the experiences that I had went through, I'd just rather not use the VA, and it's easier for me just to go through the GAMC. Thank you.
I'd say one more easy question for it. So, do you have a clinic that you're connected to? You don't go to the hospital all the time. You go to a clinic that's someplace accessible to you. Is that, or when you get your health care, where do you go?
I don't go anywhere, to be honest.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, I went to the hospital, yes. When I had the.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you very much.
Reverend Bill Beyer, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm grateful for this opportunity to share on behalf of the faith communities, part of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and the other 40 organizations that represent not only faith, labor, and low-income advocates in support of this bill to save GAMC.
If you could just state your name for the record, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'm Reverend Bill Beyer. I'm a retired ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor from Bemidji. I volunteer working at the People's Church in Bemidji, present the food shelf and things like that. So have been concerned and involved with justice issues, hunger and homelessness, and health care for many years. So I'm grateful to be able to testify here today and just sharing a little bit in the context of the people that I know, speaking to a physician who works ER in a regional hospital in Bemidji that outside of the metro area perhaps has more poverty and more people that come, or not numbers, but people in need of general assistance, I mean health care, that don't have any. Speaking to her, or listening to her, she shares a concern that, as was the testimony just before me, who shared about veterans coming oftentimes in the middle of the night, she says frequently, needing help. It's at a point where it's undiagnosed, so there isn't any special program set up, but they have problems, and the emergency hospital is trying to meet those problems. And fearful that that will be cut off because of the cost that might be involved in that. Speaking to a public health nurse that visits people in our local jails, a concern about those who are released and are between the age of 21 and 64 or whatever, and need either medication for undiagnosed mental illness or having some problems or addictions, and she was very concerned about the inability to access maybe some of the tests or some of the medicines that they might need. I spoke also to the social worker at the regional hospital and very concerned about the dynamics. I've been a rural pastor in Minneapolis and decided I'd go out to the outer parts of the state and spent 37 years in the ministry. And the dynamics, if it takes us 5 hours or 4.5 hours to get here, people that come to the hospital for care who are poor, who have no car, their family has no car, or if they have a car, it doesn't work, and they can't afford to fix the car, is a concern that she has, specifically lifting up a dialysis patient who lives 50 miles away from the hospital, who the family can't afford transportation even to get there. And so we got transportation problems, medicine problems, we got problems that relate to care. Oftentimes, if you can push your wheelchair, there is no care. And so you kind of think about that. And sometimes there are people that may be able to push a wheelchair on level ground in a building that would find it very difficult to get to the place they need to get to. I'm grateful for those who have testified. I'm thankful for this rally, and I ask for your support.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members? Thank you for coming down. Chief Butler. Welcome to the committee, and I understand congratulations are in order. You passed your fire training.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. 13 weeks of grueling duty. Glad to be here today.
Thanks for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for inviting me here today. I also want to thank you for your leadership in making the GMAC issue a priority for this year. For the record, my name is Tim Butler. I'm the fire chief of the city of St. Paul. I've served with the St. Paul Fire and Police Department for over 20 years, and I'm a U.S. military veteran, 23 years in the Coast Guard and Coast Guard Reserve. I was asked to speak today about the impacts of public safety and the first responders should the GMAC be eliminated. I'm not an expert on hospital funding. I'm not an expert on GMAC. But I feel my department plays a central role in connecting first responders, hospital administrators, and patients. I also feel I have a unique perspective on the impact the GMAC funding will have. And the cuts on both first responders and patients from around the entire state, regardless of their economic status. First, let me say categorically that maintaining quality health care for all Minnesotans is a public safety issue. Public safety personnel from fire departments and law enforcement agencies and emergency medical outfits respond and treat everyone who calls 911 for help. We don't have the option of refusing to respond, and we don't have the luxury of choosing who we serve. Without a robust system of hospitals and specialized treatment centers to back us up, my men and women will still have to respond, but they won't be able to adequately treat and address the issues that prompted the 911 call. Those patients will continue to call us and will be continually frustrated by not being able to help them. The strength of our public safety system depends on maintaining a quality healthcare system for all Minnesotans. I appreciate all of your efforts in that regard. St. Paul Fire is home of our community's first responders. Our attitude is simple. You call, we respond to help you. We don't ask how an emergency will be funded. We focus on the life, safety, and comfort of the patients we're called to help. We see up close and personal humanity at its finest and people on the worst day of their lives. I like to say that we're at the pointed end of the spear. We are where the rubber meets the road. We are where the service demand meets service delivery. St. Paul Fire and Regions Hospital established, at that time Ramsey Hospital, Regions Hospital established Minnesota's first advanced life support paramedic service in the state in 1973. Today, the department operates the largest fire-based emergency medical services program in Minnesota. There's an old saying in EMS that critical care begins in the streets. The other untold half of that quote is, of course, that we can't finish the job in the streets. We have to have a robust hospital system standing behind us to help us finish the job. On average, St. Paul paramedic units make 25,000 EMS runs per year and about one every 15 minutes. Half of those patients are taken to hospitals like Regions, Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial, and other hospitals that care for nearly 70% of the Minnesotans enrolled in GMAC. If GMAC is not adequately funded, where are my crews going to take the patients for definitive and long-term care? GMAC funding cuts will amount to a loss of about $150 million to Regions Hospital and Hennepin County Medical Center. If GMAC funds are not restored, hospitals will be forced to shift costs to other patients and insurance companies or be forced to cut services. GMAC funding impacts everyone in this state, not just the poor, because the services that will be cut will impact all aspects of hospital operations, and those operations serve all residents regardless of economic status. I'm very concerned that some of those hospital cuts will be to specialty services not available in other hospitals. Level 1 trauma centers, aviation and helicopter ambulance services, the medical resource control centers, specialized burn units, and hyperbaric chambers are five of the medical specialties most near and dear to a fire chief's heart. Several years ago, my good friend and a fellow fire chief was severely burned in a gasoline-fueled fire. Critically injured, Gary would have died in the rural area where the accident occurred. A special aviation unit from North Memorial Hospital airlifted him to Regions Hospital to the burn unit, where he spent months recovering. I think he has the distinction of having the most morphine injected into him in Minnesota history and surviving. Where will I take my injured firefighters if the burn unit at Regions and HVMC close? There are only three such units in the state, all at hospitals that care for a large portion of Minnesotans on GMAC. The medical resource control centers are largely supported by HVMC and Regions. There's two of them in the metro area. They track ambulances and hospital bed status, and they match up paramedic patient needs with the hospital beds available. They operate like air traffic control centers. Without them, there would be chaos, absolute chaos during disaster, like we experienced at the I-35W bridge collapse. A young firefighter in my department, St. Paul Fire, Rick, recently lost his father in a line of duty shooting incident. Rick Sr. was a North St. Paul police officer gunned down in an East Metro apartment building less than 6 months ago. Rick's partner, a Maplewood police officer, was wounded in gunfire in that same incident. The partner was taken to a level one trauma center at Regions. When firefighters, my firefighters, are taken there as well, when they're injured in a line of duty accident, how many times have you read in the newspaper, airlifted to a trauma center? Those two words alone, the special aviation units and the trauma centers, are what I'm concerned about, where the guys at the pointy end of the spear get in trouble. That's how they go. Level one trauma centers through an air helicopter. I'm extremely concerned that public safety responders will not have the definitive care they need if funding is cut to those trauma centers. And Regents Hospital operates the Midwest's only level one pediatric trauma center. Finally, over the Christmas holidays, two St. Paul residents were found at home by their son unconscious just minutes before they died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Rushed to the hyperbaric chamber at HCMC, they recovered after weeks of repeated treatments in that specialized facility. Carbon monoxide is also an extremely common byproduct of combustion found at all fire scenes. My firefighters are exposed to that toxic gas on a daily basis. We make 300 CO runs per year in St. Paul. Where will I take them if HCMC closes that hyperbaric unit because of a $150 million budget cut? Where? Milwaukee, that's where. Milwaukee is the next closest city with a hyperbaric chamber. The St. Paul couple, they wouldn't have made it to Hudson, much less Milwaukee. First responders and every citizen in Minnesota benefit from these specialized units at a regional medical center. The Medical Resource Control Center, burn units, the hyperbaric chambers, helo and aviation ambulance services, and the level one trauma centers are statewide assets and should continue to be funded in a large part by the state. A cut to GMAC threatens these high-risk, high-demand facilities and puts every resident at risk because there's simply no place else to go. There's no place else to go. So, Mr. Chairman, I applaud your leadership on this issue. And Representative Murphy, thank you for your authorship of this bill to continue funding for GMAC. Members of the committee, I appreciate your concerted efforts to find a practical and affordable solution to the crisis. And I know this committee has a talent and perspective to find answers that work for all Minnesotans who are enrolled in the program, and also for the hospital administrators and for the guys like me at the pointed end of the spear. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today, and be happy to address any questions you have.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you. Dr. Alexander. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Representative Sisson and committee members. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Gordy Alexander, and I'm president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center, part of Fairview. UMMC is the largest teaching facility in the state with more than 36,000 inpatient admissions each year. The Fairview system includes seven hospitals across the greater metropolitan area, Hibbing and Red Wing. I'm speaking to today on behalf of Fairview Hospitals and Clinics. It's very clear to all of us here, and thank you to those who spoke before me about the need for this. I'm going to talk a little bit about how it impacts the hospitals. You're going to hear more detail about that in the next speaker. GAMC is a vital program that serves the most vulnerable people in our state, and we need to continue finding a solution to this. The representatives, Representative Murphy and others, to create a proposal has been critical, and now, even though this isn't perfect, we need to move on. We are supportive of Fairview, and I would like to explain a little bit its impact to us. By the way, UMMC, or Fairview as a system, is the second largest recipient of GAMC funds, just behind Hennepin County. So it is something we are very well aware of, and we know its impact very intimately. If GAMC goes away, Fairview system loses $24 million. The proposed restoration returns reduces that loss somewhere between $9 and $11 million. Within the Fairview system, some hospitals will lose and some hospitals will be viewed as winners, and I'd like to address that. The main reason that a hospital might characterize itself as a winner or a loser depends on its payer mix. Let me give you an example. At UMMC, in our behavioral population, we're probably the largest hospital serving behavioral mentally ill and chemically dependent patients. We currently lose $5 million on our behavioral population. And we've done that for a long time. And it is something that we do because it's our place in the community to do so. If GAMC is cut, that $5 million will grow by $15 million at UMMC. So this is real challenge for us. We will not be making money at the end of the day, but it will make the loss to hopefully tolerable so that services will not be cut. We have a challenging payer mix. Others do not. Parts of our system the surcharge will more than double their loss from GMC. We know that as a hospital system across the state, we need to solve this problem together. I'd like to add one other thing. We're very proud of the services we provide to mentally ill and others on GAMC. This is a service we are passionate about. Others in the country have not wanted to take care of these patients, and we believe that it is imperative that we do so. We also know that the temporary fix to this problem is not the end. It's not the last word. We need to work with you and with others on fixing the way care is delivered, the way care is paid for in the state. So again, we are very supportive, thankful, Representative Murphy and many others here in this room who have worked long hours about trying to provide a temporary fix. Happy to answer questions, but I mainly would like to thank you for your support on this.
Questions, members?
So can you just the program you're losing $5 million on? Can you tell me who gets served by that program?
Well, it's our behavioral services. So chemical dependency, some mentally ill is another, and then most of these folks carry a dual diagnosis, so they don't sit sharply in one camp or the other. It's our behavioral services,
and that behavioral service doesn't just serve the GAMC population.
It does not. But that's the wider payer mix question that we're dealing with. This isn't just about GAMC, it's about Medicaid. I think in Minnesota we have relatively good mental health care services. I'm appreciative of some of the aspects of this will improve that. And then down the road we need to address the mental health services drastically.
Yeah. Representative Abler.
Thank you, and Mitch in the hall, thanks for coming today. I know you're busy, and this is an important place to spend some time, and nice to have you here. Maybe not for now, but for later. There's been a lot of numbers thrown around about what losses will happen to various hospital groups, and there's amounts that were received by a hospital before any changes have happened. There have been rate reductions lately.
Right.
It's just a heck of a time trying to serve this population or the medical assistance population or the Minnesota care population for you all, and thanks for still doing that. I think it's beyond this hearing, but at the finance hearing coming up next week, it would be helpful for me to see the numbers that you have, if current law goes forward, which is where this group stays in Minnesota care for up to 6 months, and then some may or may not enroll. What you project under current law, not with a zero that goes forward, but with the numbers you expect to trickle in from that, some of the numbers that are being spread around are simply wrong. And there was one assumption made last year that if this program gets, that if it doesn't come back, that the losses would be 100% of the general assistance medical care pot of money, and when hospitals have traditionally gotten about 40% of that. So if you could take that as a assignment, or if you want to comment about it, I'd be happy to
I'd be happy to comment, and I think Larry next, he'll be happy to talk about it soon. I think that the characterization is wrong or right is very difficult with these numbers, because we do not know how to predict the future yet. And so we are using our best guess in how that might happen, and frankly, any number you see will not be the way it is, because we don't know how many patients will get sick, we don't know how they will come to our doors. So I think orders of magnitude is what I've chosen to focus on. And we have agreed, we met with Hennepin County commissioners, and we've all agreed that we wish we had a way of talking about these numbers. And I think the Hospital Association are the numbers that I will, whether I agree totally with them or not, they will present a common methodology so that we have one way of looking at it and comparing across multiple sites. And I totally agree with you. I wish they were better. But I think that that's a challenge we're going to face until we have better systems that can report these numbers in a common way.
And I appreciate that, and the Hospital Association has been active in some of those numbers. But I, in the same way I asked the gentleman before about their specific experiences, and I mentioned little counties across the state don't always have their representation. I'm interested in what your health group expects from what your own internal numbers are, and how that extrapolates is interesting, but I'm curious about your own testimony from your own group. If you can,
that's the whole Fairview system?
Yeah, just what you see across
the
system, not for now, but just for
our
over the
best
weekend.
Guess is that we would lose GAMC if lost, and admittedly, we don't know how most of the patients we see on GAMC are not the folks that are going to be able to get into Minnesota Care, most of them. Will some get in? Sure. Will Minnesota Care go under? We don't know what's going to happen. And so the number is in the ballpark of $24 million. The fix that we're proposing, and it's changing all the time, is somewhere for Fairview between, subtracting it, will get us to a loss of between $9 and $11.5 million. So that's a loss. Now, some parts of our system, Red Wing and Ridges, have a different kind of payer mix, and they will actually do worse on the fix. Fairview, as part of our GAMC surcharge, is putting in $33 million. So those are the ballpark figures, and my dad used to say statistics never lie, but these numbers are not insignificant, and the orders of magnitude is huge.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Alexander, you just said that the general assistance medical care patients would not be eligible for Minnesota Care. Could you maybe restate that? I think
I don't think I said eligible, though I might have. They are not likely to be the kind of folks who are able to get into Minnesota Care. They don't have an HR office in some of their places. I think you heard the testimony. These folks are cobbling their lives together best they can, and frequently we have many people who come to us and have been able to be on other and Medicaid and whatever, and haven't gone through the process of the application, and GAMC has allowed us to go then help them get covered, and a lot of that coverage is going to go away.
And I just wanted to make the point, Doctor, that they are automatically enrolled under the current proposal and would continue to be. So I just wanted to make that clear.
But they also have to pay a premium.
We'll talk about that.
Okay. Later. Terrific. Applaud you for that.
Thank you for coming.
You bet.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing the 148 hospitals and 17 healthcare systems throughout our state. Minnesota's hospital community has been working hard throughout the summer and fall with multiple stakeholders and coalitions, many of whom you've heard from already today, to find an alternative to the elimination of funding for the GAMC program. Up until very recently, we were hopeful that federal health care reform, while not necessarily perfect, would have provided Medicaid coverage for our GAMC population, as well as some additional financial participation in that coverage from the federal government. That now appears unlikely, at least in the short run. Fortunately, our state elected officials and stakeholder groups working on this issue put together a GAMC solution that can move forward with or without federal health care reform. We have been moving forward believing that a scaled back, standalone GAMC program can, in fact, continue to exist. We have believed that our members would support a shared pain, shared responsibility approach to serving this vulnerable population. That being said, we acknowledge that the solution that is being offered in this legislation comes with considerable hardship for many of our hospitals. Building upon the work that was done since the 2009 session ended, MHA established a state public programs work group and began working with a consulting firm which specializes in the financing of state public health care programs to help us find specific options for financing a revised program. I should also add, we are looking at this from a phased approach with a short-term phase which represents the current legislation, a mid-term phase which would involve some perhaps different funding mechanisms to make this more sustainable, and longer term, as Dr. Alexander pointed out, offering up some suggestions for program reform both on the delivery and the payment side that again would help make this program more sustainable long term. We challenged our consultants to look under every rock and explore all approaches to see what we could do here in Minnesota. Our options were very limited, given that new tax revenues have been taken off the table and the state faces a $1.2 billion shortfall. In the short term, the Medicaid surcharge proved to be the only real option to bring any new monies into a GAMC solution. These funds could be used to bring in additional federal matching funds through enhanced medical assistance payment rates, mitigating the surcharge impact to the community, hospital community as a whole. But in light of declining state revenues, we believe maximizing the receipt of available federal dollars should be a priority as lawmakers struggle to provide coverage to this population, as well as some level of provider payments. The federal government saves millions of dollars through geographic disparities in the Medicare payment formula, which makes Minnesota one of the lowest paid states in the country, despite the fact that we are continually at the top for quality of services provided. This presents an opportunity to recover some of those federal dollars for the benefit of Minnesotans. At our January meeting, the Minnesota Hospital Association's Board of Directors voted to support a Medicaid surcharge, not because all of the MHA members embraced this type of financing mechanism, but because it offered the best hope of funding a standalone GAMC program, which we continue to believe is the right thing to do for the poorest and sickest residents of our state. My staff has been diligently working to find an appropriate formula for using a portion of the surcharge monies to improve medical assistance payments, thereby leveraging additional federal matching dollars. We have also tried to focus on maintaining coverage for this population while trying to juggle two somewhat competing goals: mitigating the impact of the GAMC line item veto, particularly for those hospitals that serve the greatest percentage of GAMC patients, while narrowing the impact that an increased Medicaid surcharge will have on our hospitals. The bill language includes many of the approaches supported by the MHA board. We are continuing work on a formula of surcharge increases and medical assistance rate adjustments that will pass federal regulatory scrutiny and provide some equity regarding its impact on all of our members. That being said, you cannot take a $400 million GAMC program down to half its size and believe that a formula change can make everyone whole. The surcharge does impact our hospitals differently, so we are working to try to find the most equitable solution possible. It is important to note that the hospitals that are likely to receive less in Medicaid payments than they pay in increased surcharges are those hospitals that have not borne the brunt of large medical assistance or GAMC volumes, which pay far below cost, and I believe Dr. Alexander referenced that in his testimony. While the surcharge is not perfectly equitable, neither is the payer mix across the state. Representative Murphy has asked me to explain a spreadsheet that you have in your packets at the table. And this is an example of what we're working on in terms of the formula that was discussed. I'll give you just a second to look at that. This particular iteration of this formula is not included in the current bill as it exists. This was amended into the Senate bill yesterday, or it was presented to the Senate. It was not actually adopted. But the spreadsheet shows all of the hospitals in the state listed alphabetically by community. The first column shows the amount of additional surcharge that the hospitals would pay into the state through the surcharge increases that are proposed in the bill. The second column shows the effect of a 16-month medical assistance rate increase of 14% for those hospitals located in Hennepin and Ramsey County, and 18% for hospitals located elsewhere in the state of Minnesota. The next column, the third column, shows the impact of bringing the 16 rural DRGs that you have discussed before this committee in the past, bringing those rates up to 100% of the metro average rateable increase. The next column is an attempt to again move money to those providers that are providing high levels of service to this population and to the medical assistance population. That column represents a add-on payment for private not-for-profit hospitals that serve a high number of obstetrical patients on medical assistance. The next column to the right shows an add-on payment for private not-for-profit hospitals that serve a high number of mental health patients that also are on medical assistance in GAMC. The next column is a small volume adjuster that affects primarily our smaller hospitals in the state. And this is an add-on payment of 17% for those hospitals that are located in Class 3 and Class 4 cities, as defined in Minnesota statute. The next column basically does the math to compute all of those previous columns to provide a net impact from the surcharge and the Medicaid, the medical assistance rate adjustments. Then we show the loss of GAMC funding in the next column from the bill, which provides for a 50% rate reduction for all providers for the first 4 months, a 70% reimbursement for hospitals in the next 12 months that treat a large number of GAMC patients, and a 40% reimbursement for those hospitals that treat a smaller number of GAMC patients for the next 12 months. It maintains the 50% rate reduction for all other providers. The net, after all of that, with the partial GAMC restoration is shown in the second to the last column. And then the final column shows what we projected to be the loss under current law, with GAMC funding being eliminated on March 1st of this year. And let me address Representative Abler's questions. We have not computed the Minnesota Care impact. We can take a stab at that. It's, again, as Dr. Alexander pointed out, it's pretty difficult to tell who will qualify, who won't. We know that there will be automatic enrollment for that period of eligibility that they have left in their first 6 months of eligibility, and trying to figure all that out will be difficult, but we would certainly try to take a stab at that and look at what that might be. I would also point out that the numbers for our critical access hospitals, those are the smallest hospitals in our state. There are 79 of them. They're hospitals with less than 25 beds. These numbers are overstated as well, because we believe, and the accounting firms that we've talked to believe, that the surcharge is an allowable expense under Medicare, and critical access hospitals are able to receive 101% of their allowable charges in their Medicare reimbursement. So some of that money will flow back to them in subsequent periods through Medicare funding that will offset the numbers on this spreadsheet. This is an iteration that we completed late last week. I think the numbers that are in the bill were done a couple of weeks ago. We're working on a couple new ideas, as was mentioned, to try to smooth out the impact on this among our members. And it's very, very unequal, and we understand that that's controversial within our membership and within the legislature itself. We hope that lawmakers will recognize that the hospital community is stepping forward to try to do the right thing for the poorest of our state. We are willing to share in the pain and responsibility for maintaining coverage for this population through a scaled-back, standalone GAMC program. But we are stretching the ability of our members to maintain the safety net all Minnesota hospitals provide to our state's residents. We urge you to work with us in the days ahead to continue to improve the funding and payment formulas found in the bill to address hospital concerns while still supporting a funding source for the GAMC program. Thank you for your time and your work on this difficult issue.
Thank you. Ms. Mugabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Massa, first of all, I appreciate the hard work you've been doing. We met over the interim as well on some ideas, and I think you're going to see some bipartisan ideas for how we put this on a more sustainable footing going forward. But that having been said, I've been a bit perplexed by the column in the spreadsheet. Again, I know this isn't a Finance Committee hearing, but as long as we're talking about these numbers and the impacts, I want to make sure we're clear. Where it says GAMC losses under current law, that assumes that there is no other payer or no other program through which these people would be served and therefore revenue coming into the hospitals, correct?
That is correct. We simply took the amount of GAMC reimbursement that our hospitals received in the prior period because that was a known number at this point.
So, for example, if as is currently proposed that they are automatically enrolled in Minnesota Care, you would be receiving reimbursement
that
of that
number
program.
Would go down, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
President Ava.
Oh, thanks. Part of my question just got answered. Is that column we're talking about was the third one from the right, the GAMC loss?
The column I think we're talking about is the very last column. That assumes the loss of all GAMC reimbursement.
All right, thanks. So, Mr. Chair, and these are based on actual numbers. I know last year we discussed proposed what might happen as 100% is at 40%. This is actual dollars that based on last year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, these are based on the numbers in our system of what we believe our members were paid last year.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I appreciate coming forward. This is a hard project, and I just knowing that there was quite a hearing yesterday, I guess, and some of that got kind of heated. And I know that you are the head of a group. Not all members come. Not all members are able to get away. And I hope that when the dust settles on this, that there's not some little outstate hospital or a middle-sized one who finds themselves in harm's way through no fault of their own, where they were serving a population, and now they can't serve their own people that they've been serving all this time. And some of the numbers here that are considerable, 800,000 and over a million for some of these areas. And I know my hospitals are a little larger, and even though they have challenges, they have some economy of scale. They can shift some staff and do some things. But I know it's on your mind, but I just keep I'm not sure how I got to this spokesman for people who aren't here today. But, you know, we just started, and some people think we're in Washington, by the way. You know. But there are many voices, many groups, and we've heard from many of the people affected from the clients of General Assistance Medical Care. But I hope you keep putting feelers out through your backwaters to make sure that all your hospitals, members or not, will know that what's going on, and it's a good time to speak up to their legislators. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative yes. Abler, we are absolutely doing that. We are trying to be as transparent as possible with our members as well as with the legislature on here's what it is. And we're open to all kinds of suggestions and trying to improve this as we move forward.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Caldwell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Murphy. Welcome back. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you today. I do want to comment specifically on the transfer of the CCSA funds and the Mental Health Integrated Fund to a newly created GAMC account, which is included as Section 32 as part of the solution to the GAMC problem. That's what I'll be focusing my testimony on today. First, I want to say that counties recognize I guess I would say the inevitability of some kind of a county contribution as part of the GMC solution. This is because in addition to the harm to low-income people, Minnesotans who need health care, we do recognize that we would incur costs if JMC were funding were eliminated. And I believe that Keith Carlson from MICA testified to your joint committee in December, talking about the original proposal in the bill that was a 10% county cost share that we saw as completely unacceptable as a way of funding for many reasons, and he outlined those, the precedent that it would set, the fact that it would be likely to grow as the state budget pressures increases, and kind of the idea that it basically is not particularly transparent in that you're using sort of the county checkbook to solve state responsibilities. So we do really appreciate that this perspective has been considered and that another alternative is being proposed. Representative Murphy has been very open to ideas and just wanting to look at a number of different solutions. We really appreciate that. We do also appreciate that the reduction to the grants that's described in the amendment is temporary. County's view is that reductions to the community Children's and Community Services Act and the mental health grants are a better alternative than the county cost share because it doesn't create an obligation, however temporary, that counties are responsible for health care costs across the state for low-income people. We believe that that's a state responsibility and that there should be state equity in that. However, we do believe that the reductions to these grants will have severe implications for those individuals who are served. I do want to take a couple of minutes to comment on the implications of cutting these grants and to share what we still would think is a better alternative if there's a way to make it happen, and then also just to reconsider that ask the legislature to reconsider the level of reductions that are proposed. First, CCSA, and I think some of this predates some of you, so a little bit of background. CCSA is a block grant that's distributed to counties on a formula basis. It consists of both federal and state funds, and it has a variety of allowable uses. CCSA is one of the few sources of state dollars available for child welfare, basically child protection, and the majority of CCSA funds are used for this purpose. Other allowable uses would include services for people with disabilities, vulnerable adults, and children with mental health problems. The loss of that amount of funding for these services will severely limit counties in their ability to respond to child maltreatment, elder abuse, and supportive services for disabled people. I want to comment, too, that those reductions come on top of the governor's unallotment of CCSA last summer. That was a $16.9 million reduction in 2010 and $22.5 million for 2011. So if the reduction in this bill were at the level that's proposed right now, combined with the governor's unallotment for 2011, would be a 58.6% reduction in state funds for that grant. CCSA also pays for child protection workers in counties, and I just wanted to comment that DHS recently did a workload study analysis and found that there currently are not sufficient staff statewide to meet the statutory requirements. So a large cut to CCSA at this point would result in reductions to county workers, so there'd be fewer staff available to provide protection to these vulnerable adults. Next, a little bit about mental health. Many of the mental health grants that are outlined here were created to transition people into the community as the regional treatment centers were closed. They've been used to develop regional partnerships among counties and coordinate with mental health centers and other community services. They provide for community support for really vulnerable people. Some may be more vulnerable than some of those who are served through GMC. A substantial cut to those services would jeopardize those community supports, which seems kind of an irony. It supports things like rent subsidies, services to mental health centers with adults with serious and persistent mental illness. Some of them are on GMC, many of them are on MA. Losing the funds means that counties would be forced to end housing subsidies, which would create a homeless population in order to provide medical coverage. And I know that Representative Murphy is aware of all of this. We have been asked whether counties believe that it's better to have GAMC services go away than to sustain a large cut to these programs. And I have to say that that feels to us like a real Sophie's choice. Is it better to assure that very low-income, chemically dependent, and mentally ill people continue to get health care, or to assure that children are safe from abuse and neglect? Is it better to assure that people with mental illness get medication or lose housing? I guess I have to say that I'm really sorry that our state is forced to make those kinds of choices. As we do understand the reality of counties having to contribute to a GMC solution, we did suggest another alternative that I know is outside of the scope of this committee, but I just want to put it on the table to let you know some of our thinking about it, and maybe it can be considered in the overall deliberations on this. And that would be looking at a cut to the county program aid, which is basically the general government aid, our version of LGA, that goes to the counties. It's provided to counties. Basically, the idea is to help reduce property taxes based on each county's tax base or ability to pay and economic need. So it's a broader source of funding than the block grants. Given the current condition of the state budget, we think that county property taxpayers will be asked to provide more resources for state programs such as GMC and child support services. To us, it doesn't make sense for the state to provide property tax relief to county with county program aid and then cut funding that counties have to backfill or lots of services with the other. It's just not a very transparent way of financing the system. We hope that the legislature will step back and just think about whether it's really in the public's interest to cut state funding for child care and vulnerable populations, but still kind of give the impression that we can provide meaningful tax relief. So I just encourage you, even though I know it's outside of the jurisdiction of this committee, to kind of think through if there's a way to find a solution to that. Finally, our suggestion has been that any county contribution that is made should not exceed the amount for which counties would be liable if GMC were eliminated. I think, like everybody else, we feel that we need to pay our fair share, and that varies, of course, as Representative Abler pointed out, from one county to another, although I don't think it's exclusively a metro problem. There are some small counties that would be impacted as well. But not wanting to, I guess, cover other parts of the cost. We have done some more analysis since our earlier testimony. We've identified in social services costs maybe $12 to $14 million in what our liability, I guess I would say, would be if GMC were eliminated. For things like outpatient mental health, inpatient mental health, chemical dependency, the Minnesota care premiums, a little bit on health care costs for county jail inmates. What we have not done, and we're finding a very difficult time getting a handle on, is some of those other jail costs and law enforcement costs that both cities and counties would be liable for. We recognize that those exist. They probably are significant, but we just have not been able to get a handle on that. So what we would like to do as you get your fiscal notes is just to continue that discussion with you and to try to arrive at some kind of an agreement about what would be the most equitable county contribution. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have. I also have someone else here who can provide more information on a county cost analysis if you want to take the time for that. We have shared that with Representative Murphy, and she's aware of what we have.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Cole, you sort of answered my question when you said you don't have the data on corrections and that sort of thing.
Unfortunately, no. Yeah, we just aren't able to identify what we think would be, I guess, accurate assumptions about how many people there would be who would maybe be picked up off the street or would be, you know, put in jails as a result of that. We'd be glad to try to, you know, brainstorm with people to try to find out what those might be.
Mr. Chair, in the city of Duluth, we have a facility, San Marco Apartments, that takes people basically off the street, gives them a home. Almost all of them are in GAMC. Almost all of them have mental health issues. And it's, by having that facility there with the medications from GAMC, it's greatly reduced the rearrest and rearrest and rearrest and detox after detox for this particular population. If they can't get their drugs and their medications that they need, they will be back on the streets, and the city and county's costs are going to go back up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I've been to the San Marco Center. I'm really impressed with it as well. And I think we are going to be looking in the next year or two at some proposals that will hopefully help coordinate more of those health and social services, such as, you know, is included under the coordinated care proposal that's in this bill, maybe framed in a different way. We really think that is what needs to happen in the long term. Unfortunately, those proposals don't yield immediate cost savings in many cases. So we are putting sort of a Band-Aid on the situation here, I think, while sort of paving the way for longer term solutions.
Further discussion or questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Witten.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I have some handouts for the committee. They're printed on both sides.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. My name is Benjamin Whitten. I'm a primary care physician practicing in Minneapolis, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota Medical Association. The Minnesota Medical Association represents more than 11,000 physicians and medical students from throughout the state. We represent physicians from every medical specialty and from every practice style and environment. Firstly, I would like to commend you and everyone in this room today for their efforts to maintain coverage for the approximately 30,000 Minnesotans who will lose their GAMC coverage on April 1st. The MMA agrees that we must find a way to provide coverage for people covered by the GAMC program. This legislature and the governor, as recently as 2008 in the Health Care Reform Act, restated a commitment to achieving universal coverage as a way to provide care in the most cost-effective manner and to address uncompensated care and cost shifting. The MMA shares that goal, but is frustrated by the quick retreat that is now underway. I say this because the proposals on the table are not viable solutions to the problem. Governor Pawlenty's approach is to shift GAMC's enrollees to Minnesota Care. To some, this may sound like streamlining, but it isn't real reform. It achieves savings by assuming individuals will not get care because many of the enrollees will be unable to pay the Minnesota Care monthly premium and manage the required application processes. This move would also fundamentally change the purpose of the Minnesota Care program and also would result in the Health Care Access Fund going broke next year. The bill before you today, authored by Representative Murphy, would maintain the GAMC program and provide some payments to safety net hospitals, important hospitals such as Hennepin County Medical Center, Regions, and others. However, it is funded by shifting substantial costs to these same hospitals and also shifting costs to medical clinics and other health care providers. Reluctantly, the MMA cannot support either of these options. The bill before you today proposes to cut payments to medical clinics by 50%. These cuts are on top of payments that are already absurdly low. Let me remind everyone that the current public program payments in Minnesota are based on median charges from 1989, 21 years ago. This fee schedule was adopted by the legislature in 1992 and has received only one across-the-board increase in the last 18 years. That was 3% in the last 18 years. During the same time period, inflationary costs facing clinics and physicians in practice have increased nearly 30%. Adding to the challenge is the fact that legislation was adopted last year to further cut these payments by 6.5% for non-primary care services. I have provided you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee with a graph showing Medicaid payments, Medicare payments, and inflation trends from 1998 to 2009. The pink line shows the cumulative annual change in the Urban Consumer Price Index. The blue line shows that Medicare, which obviously Congress controls, is paying less in 2009 than it was paying in 1998. It's paying less now than it was 11 years ago. The yellow line shows the cumulative annual change in Minnesota's public program payments with the one-time 3% increase in 2000. What is not shown on this graph is a 6.5% cut for non-primary care services. Let me give you some examples of just how low these payments are. The second graph you have, back of the first, compares reimbursements for two of the most frequent codes, an office visit for a new patient and an office visit for an established patient. The chart compares Minnesota public program rates, Medicare rates, the average private insurer rate as reported by Community Measurement, and Medicaid rates from our four surrounding states. Minnesota payment for these services, Mr. Chair, is 47% of what Medicare pays, less than half. Compared to private insurers, Minnesota payments are 35% of what the private insurers pay, about one-third. You can also see that we are significantly behind every one of our neighboring states in their Medicaid payment rates. In fact, an April 2009 Health Affairs article found that for the five-year period, 2003 to 2008, Minnesota was the only state in the country to actually reduce fees for physician services, while the average state increase was 15%. The same article showed that Minnesota Medicaid payments for primary care are already the 45th lowest in the country. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these rates are already ridiculously low. The current bill proposes cutting these rates by 50%. If you fail to provide reasonable rates payments for services, eventually the services cannot be provided and low-income patients will not be able to access medical care. We're not yet at that point in Minnesota, and I'm happy to say that, but we are precariously close. Physicians have strong ethical and professional obligations and traditions of treating all patients, but we also face practical limitations. One of my colleagues from St. Cloud recently said to me, if it were just the care that I were asked to provide for free, I could gladly do that, but I can't provide the services any longer. I can't do it any longer. So the current $30 payment for a new patient seen in a physician's office, the clinic must pay the rent and the utilities, pay for the equipment and supplies, pay for medical liability coverage, pay staff to obtain prior authorization for a prescription or subsequent service, pay staff to verify the patient's eligibility, pay staff to develop and submit a bill, document the visit in the medical record, and maybe finance an electronic medical record system, and collect and submit data. This bill would cut that payment to $15. Is it any wonder why further cuts cannot be absorbed? The MMA strongly encourages the legislature to find a long-term solution to the GAMC problem. We must ensure continued coverage for this population, but we cannot solve it by passing the cuts onto the physicians, clinics, and hospitals that all of us rely on to keep us healthy and treat us when we are ill. Although efforts to raise revenue can be politically unpopular, the MMA supports a balanced approach to solving our fiscal problems, including raising broad-based taxes if needed. Continuing to try to cut our way out of this problem will only cause greater problems down the road. The state has a responsibility to ensure access to high-quality services to Minnesotans throughout the state. And we have a wonderful healthcare system in Minnesota, and we've heard from those already who provide fantastic hospitalization services and emergency medical services. But we also need to provide services at the basic level. As I say to my patients, it's my job, the job of people like me, to keep you out of the hospital, keep you from making that 911 call, and I'm real good at it. The proposal before you today seriously erodes that capacity. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would be happy, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions that your committee might have.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your comments, and thank you for being here. I have a question. I just out of curiosity, there's recently a book that was released entitled The Moral Underground, and it talks about in different areas of specialty, medical field being one of them, providers will sometimes do what they can as far as adjusting the bill. They will maybe lower the charges because they know that they are seeing somebody who is who has a hardship case, for example. So they take it upon their own to adjust what they see as kind of an injustice in the system, and they undercharge. And I'm wondering, you know, I can say that I know I see it in my clinic as a nurse practitioner. I know I've done it myself. And I'm wondering if the if this is going on and we really haven't seen, we're close to a breaking point. I'm not sure if I'm not being very clear here, but I think the system has worked for as so well as for so long because of things like this that are happening, and we are now asking the medical profession to take another hit. And if that's something that the MMA, I think it would be interesting to find out if members are doing that. If you know that among providers that they are adjusting fees because they are trying to create the justice that they correct for the injustice that they see.
Thank you for your question, Representative. We've been doing that for a long time, and I've heard many of my colleagues out in rural Minnesota and elsewhere in the city saying, look, we're losing money. We're losing money on these public assistance patients. And there's kind of a bad joke that's been going around, I don't know, the last few years, you know, if you're losing $5 or $10 or $15 on every visit, you can't make it up on volume. Yes, we forgive co-pays. We've got patients unemployed and can't pay, and there's barriers. We do everything we can. We've tried to get medications for them, everything we can to provide care. But we have to pay taxes, and we have to pay staff, and we have to provide medical liability protection. And you know, we're running, we'd like to say we just have a profession, but we also have a business, so we won't be able to provide our services. And that would be my message. Thank you.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Whitten, if I could ask, what if we had a long-term solution for this population that paid providers, your members of the MMA, commercial rates? Would that be helpful?
MMA would look at any long-term solution, Representative, to providing health care for this population.
Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Whitten, I was specifically asking, though, if we had a long-term solution that provided commercial rates to providers instead of low MA, low Medicare, and percentages less of that, would that be helpful or hurtful?
Well, as I understand the question, you're basically saying, what if instead of seeing these patients at a loss or even a break-even point, you were able to see them and charge the same as you would be charging somebody with regular insurance? It's really was not our what we're asking for, but if there's some proposal like any solution, Representative, that would maintain access for this group of patients, both at the primary care level and for the tertiary services that many of them will need, would be wonderful. We all have a saying, the devil is in the details, so we still would have to see what it is. Would we talk about it? Of course.
Okay. Any further questions for this witness?
Dr. Whitten.
Yes. Representative Hulley.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Whitten, on this one, that's a procedure. It's not really the total spending. This is per procedure, I would think.
This is actually Representative Huntley, inflation trends, and I believe it's just showing fee-for-service rates. The pink line is consumer price index. Medicaid has been flat, and Medicare has gone up and down. So that's basically just inflation trends. If you need more, nuts and bolts specifics, I have people here with technical expertise that can answer your question, but that's my best understanding.
I can get that later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if we could get information about what excluded targeted programmatic code and specialty charges are referring to, that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what you were talking about. Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right here. hiding behind all these people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for being here today and for your testimony. I'm wondering what you think of the non-financial portions of the bill that that Representative Murphy is proposing. She's got some policy change here to try to deal with the needs of this population, and I wonder, since this actually is the policy committee and will be doing a lot more with the finance, I wonder if you could comment on the rest of what's in the bill.
Dr. Whitten.
Could I ask first a specific question about a specific policy, for example?
Well,
absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm perhaps not the best person to give the nutshell explanation of it. Maybe if you're not prepared to do that today, we could talk about it some other time. I don't mean to put you on the spot on that, but there is part of this proposal is an attempt to maybe save a little bit of money by just providing better care in the area of psychiatric rapid response to crises, attempts to keep people out of the hospital and that kind of thing. But I certainly don't mean to put you on the spot, and if you get an opportunity to look at that portion of it and you had any comments, I'd be happy to know what they are.
May I respond?
Yes, Dr. Whitten.
We would respond, favor anything that increases access to mental health services in this population. Minnesota has been a leader in the field of advocating for mental health parity, and this is a population that has been severely afflicted. We get a lot of psychiatric health issues in our practice every day. That's part of what we do. We, in addition to discounting fees and taking care of psychiatric issues, we advocate for patients. If you don't have, it's true, we need an emergency response team, and we need these wonderful tertiary centers. We couldn't take care of our patients without them, but they don't all need them, and hopefully many won't. So without the people on the ground, who's going to provide those services?
Thank you.
So people on GMC come to the folks you're representing. How? I mean, some of your doctors work in these hospitals, presumably, right? Some of your members.
Yes.
And then you're talking, though, about the people, they get, if they're not employees of the hospital, they would get reimbursed because they're providing their services there, but reimbursed separately. Is that how that works?
Well,
or they show up in your clinics and get reimbursed. I'm just wondering where these people end up, and are you going to be seeing these patients anyway, or do some of your doctors, would they choose at some point because they are getting a low rate to turn them away?
There are clinics in Minnesota already who take, or for whatever reasons, perhaps geographic reasons or financial reasons, have very few of these patients, and others who have really opened their doors to them. I think that as reimbursement goes down and down, it will be more difficult. We'll see migration of people to those areas that are still accepting them and able to provide care for them, and I think it'll swamp them. So I'm talking more of a non-hospital setting, clinics and physicians in the community.
And so the situation is that patients will call up and say, I have this need, you know, for medical care, and the clinic will say, we can't fit you into our schedule?
Well, Representative Tyson, I don't know frankly, I don't know the nuts and bolts of it. I can just tell you that if we look at an analogous situation in New Jersey, for example, where they've achieved this wonderful goal of providing service for a great number of people on their public assistance program, but the rates are so low that people can't find a physician who is either A, willing, or B, able to take care of them. They simply say, "We're sure you can come, and we have first opening is in 6 months," or "No, we're not accepting new patients."
Okay, and I'm just asking because, you know, we're going, well, we can, Mr. Renner is here.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner, also with the Minnesota Medical Association. Just to clarify, just remember, current law, we have what's called Rule 101 in Minnesota, so all medical practices must take public programs up into 20% of their caseload. So All clinics currently are serving. We think they will continue to serve. What we are starting to see and what our fear is that clinics are starting to close down certain services. If you are offering a service in a, if you have multiple sites, and one of your sites is an area that has a large population of JMC, you may decide to close that site, or you may decide to move certain services out of that site. So the fear we have is that, yes, physicians will continue to serve, but they may start making business decisions that say, we can't continue to serve in those areas. That's what creates potential access problems.
Right. And I don't want to sound unsympathetic here. The what we're doing to rates, and I totally understand that. But we are in a situation also, and setting aside the Minnesota care piece, and we need to work through that, you know, how those two pieces fit together. You know, you're getting nothing versus getting something. And I think, you know, that's the reality that we're living with right now. And I think it's important that we all understand, you know, that we're trying to fill the glass up to half full instead of emptying it from full down to half.
And Mr. Chair, members, we acknowledge that difficulty. I think the message we're trying to get to you is for many, many, many years, in both good economic times and bad economic times, physician payments have not been adjusted. And our fear is we will have a program for which people will still not be able to get access because you are putting these clinics in severe financial difficulty.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
One more.
Okay, President Huntley.
So, Mr. Chair, and this is a comment, we already have the access problem with dentistry, despite the Rule 101. And the Rule 101 says you can't treat state employees unless you take up to, and many dental providers have decided not to treat state employees as well. And so the low reimbursement rates ultimately will have the decrease in access results.
Yes. Mr. Stevens, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Tyson and Representative Murphy, for your hard work, and committee members. My name is Robert Stevens. I'm the CEO of Ridgeview Medical Center in Waconia, Minnesota. And I'm here not just representing Ridgeview, but also 9 other organizations, District 1 Hospital in Faribault, Douglas County Hospital in Alexandria, Lakeview Hospital in Stillwater, LifeCare Medical Center in Roseau, New River Medical Center in Monticello, Northfield Hospital in Northfield, Renville County Hospital and Clinics in Olivia, and River Health in Crookston, and Ortonville Healthcare Services in Ortonville, Minnesota. This is my 32nd year of being a healthcare administrator in Minnesota in great towns like Granite Falls, Thief River Falls, New Ulm, and now Waconia. I've had the privilege and really do, I think, understand some of the complexities and issues that happen, particularly in small community hospitals. Today, I want to just share with you some information that's being handed out that I think is a little bit more direct in terms of who are kind of the winners and losers in this, and how does the disbursement of funds happen in this legislation. The details of this disbursement of funds and how hospitals will benefit or not by this has only been really revealed to the MHA membership in the last several weeks. It's been very complex. I commend the MHA staff for all the work that they're doing, and in fact what you're seeing right now changed as of 6:30 last night when the latest revision came through MHA. And I want to just point out some of the complexity, and some might even say how convoluted the formula is in terms of how hospitals will get reimbursed under this legislation. You've talked about the Tier 3 and Tier 4 communities. Robbinsdale is a Tier 3 community. Northfield is not. That's a swing of no dollars in the recent update to Northfield and $4.5 million to Robbinsdale. There's North Country, which is up in Bemidji, which has a large medical assistance population, which just yesterday was going to gain $3.5 million, and today over $5 million in the swing of how those dollars are dispersed under these formulas. It's not an easy situation for MHA. It's not an easy thing for this committee, for Representative Murphy, the Senate side yesterday, to deal with this. But there's got to be more discussion, more thought. And one of the things that I would ask for is that we have an extra 30 days. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but to slow down a little bit allow some of the membership of MHA, allow the authors to go back and look at some of the harm that's being done to some of our smallest hospitals. I can tell you that if this bill would have been in effect in 2009, it would have erased the entire operating margin for Ridgeview Medical Center, gone to zero. We're not part of a system. In fact, of the hospitals that I've shown on one sheet, 57, I've only taken out the hospitals that are not part of systems. Those hospitals do not have the ability to share the pain across the system like Fairview does, or Alina does, or Health East. They have to absorb it themselves. They have to be cognizant of their bondholders or their taxpayers in some cases. And it's important that we understand that these are individual hospitals that are maybe going to be hurt by this because of their location. Because of their location. So we're not opposed to this legislation. In fact, I think in many ways it's done really good things in terms of psychiatric care, the urgent care, the quick in and access points, some really good parts of this legislation. We would ask you to take a little bit of a deep breath. Don't pass this too soon. Allow the MHA, who's working even on a version, I think, today, allow them time, allow this committee time to really think about the impact. There are unintended consequences of every piece of legislation. What I wouldn't want to see is an unintended consequence that some hospital went out of business or had to merge when they really didn't want to with the system just to stay afloat. So we would ask, I would ask on behalf of these other nine hospitals and Ridgeview Medical Center to allow us some time to further understand how MHA can work to balance this. I understand there's another piece of legislation that's coming through. We'd like to look at that. And I would say that we're not unsympathetic, particularly to Hennepin County Medical Center. And I'll share with you just quickly, Ridgeview Medical Center is the largest referrer of trauma cases to Hennepin County Medical Center. Eight out of our nine emergency room physicians were trained at Hennepin County Medical Center. We have a Hennepin County Medical Center telerobot in our ED to help diagnose stroke today. It's a great organization. We want to see that organization not just survive, but thrive. However, we don't want to do it at the expense of our own health and well-being in the city of Waconia. We think there's some ways to help. We've made some minor offers to send two of our social workers down to Hennepin County for a full month to sit and help people get on to medical assistance if they qualify. We employ 40 physicians. We would make at least five of our primary care physicians available to do at no cost assessments, histories, physicals on CAMC patients to see if they qualify for medical assistance. We know that that's one hurdle or one barrier sometimes. So we're not immune to it. We want Hennepin County for our own interests to survive, but not at tremendous financial cost to us or some of the other hospitals in the state. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just want to touch on something you were mentioning, and that is you were asking perhaps that we not pass this today till these issues have been ironed out. And I think the intent today is to pass the concept of policy. And my hope is I share some of the very same concerns you have. My own area down in Olmsted County has winners and losers in this bill. And I do know that MHA continues to work diligently to try to find a solution with Representative Murphy that can work for everybody, knowing the dire straits we're in. But it's my understanding that today we will pass the concept of policy. I think Representative Dean has a bill, too, that we'll listen to and perhaps pass on as well, and that the financial mechanisms will be worked out in Representative Huntley's committee, is my understanding. And so at least today, from my perspective, I'm willing to pass these bills on for some fiscal notes today, but I wanted to maybe allay some fears that a passage in today's committee doesn't necessarily mean that what you see leaving the floor today from this committee is what you will ultimately see in the next committee or eventually to the House floor.
Thank you.
President Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stevens, thank you for being here today, or Mr. Stevens. Appreciate your comments. I have my only hospital in my district is Lakeview in Stillwater, but I also have Woodwinds, which is part of a large system on the border of my district. And as you mentioned, in terms of the impact, if this had been in place last year for your hospital, you would have lost your entire net operating income. Lakeview Hospital in Stillwater would lose at least 40% of its net operating income if this was passed next year. And that operating income has plays a huge role in our community. So things like youth alcohol drug programs that they support through community initiatives, diabetes management programs that they do terribly in the industry, or cancer, other kinds of programs in the community, might be have to scale back for our community. So there are definite effects of the loss of this level of income to our hospital. In addition to the possibility of having to merge away just to stay afloat, those kinds of things, and they have a strong, wonderful community hospital tradition, often a top award winner nationally in terms of its rankings, that they should be allowed to maintain and encouraged to maintain. So I share with you a deep concern about this for hospitals like yours and like you and the others you mentioned. And clearly in the days ahead, we'll be working with you, with the head president of Lakeview Hospital, Kurt Geisler, and with the hospital association to see where we can move with this. President Geisler did share some specific ideas with me yesterday. Already I've learned some of them are not viable because of federal law and various other things. Some of them, I think, do have promise, so I look forward to working with you others and exploring those. I do also share your concern with the pace of things because, I mean, I learned some of this just yesterday, and we have our finance committee next Tuesday. That does seem a bit rapid. There's reasons we need to do rapid this session, but we shouldn't do it at the expense of these small community hospitals. So I agree with you. Today, like Representative Norton, I think I'm looking forward to hopefully passing both of these bills on to get fiscal notes. But certainly my support next Tuesday will be contingent upon these issues either being addressed adequately, or I will be, you know, voting to in the negative to support holding off until we have more information and done further work. So thank you for being here and sharing the perspective of this group of hospitals with us today.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stevens, I understand if you just look at it from a particular viewpoint, it does look like a fiscal burden. But I have to respond to the concept that you would occasionally loan personnel to the concentrated areas to help people enroll or maybe take a medical history. And I think that's part of the problem that goes beyond whether the fiscal fix on this particular problem. And that is that I think every community throughout the state has to step up to people who have unique and troubling needs. And because we haven't done that, we have over-concentrated the burden of serving people with unique, difficult, expensive, chronic, and demanding needs into certain communities. Mm-hmm. And we've pulled them away from their support services. We've pulled them away from friends and family and people they went to school with, which is part of success if you're dealing with really tough issues of mental health or chemical dependency. You need that support system in addition to access to the medical care, ongoing monitoring, prescriptions, and stability in your life. And we heard from the first veteran who spoke today. He grew up in a rural community like many on the hospital list that you just showed us. He then spent much of his time in a collar suburban community. But now a veteran who has served our community and our country is now finding himself having to live in the city of Minneapolis in Harbor Lights, a homeless shelter, because those communities that have been touchstones in his life don't have homeless shelters with those kind of supports and those kind of clinics and those kind of physicians and health providers who are willing to step up and help him regain stability and health in his life. And I think that as we deal with this, we have to wrestle out with the solution. And I really admire everyone bringing their problems to the table, and we'll try and address them as best we can, including for the hospitals that you represent. But I think we all have to pull back and realize that part of the difficulty that Representative Murphy has encountered and really wrestled hard with is the fact that we don't have equal access to the kind of support services that people need in all parts of the state. And so the solution is hard to come up with on a statewide basis when we have such uneven resources. And so I just really feel like it's going to take more than just continuing to concentrate the problem. We're going to have to, over the years, evolve a better support system statewide.
May I respond?
Yes, absolutely. Mr. Stevens.
Thank you for those comments. And it does not go unnoticed, the good work that is done in both Ramsey and Hennepin County and Abbott. And from our standpoint, we budgeted for a $900,000 loss of GMHC funds, that it was going away. What we didn't budget for was a $2 million deficit. And if you would look at the documents that I provided to you, we didn't think that 19 hospitals should actually benefit and profit from it. And I'll go back to Bemidji. If the GMC or TAMC program stayed in place, they would have garnered about $2.3 million. But with it going away and under this legislation, there's a $7.5 million swing. Another $5.5 million are going to them. I'm not sure that's right. And that's what I'd like some time to correct, or at least help to correct. We are willing in Waconia to do our share because Hennepin County Medical Center, and I'll just say them, they're a fabulous resource for the state in so many ways. And we don't want them to go away. And I should also say, because we are the number one referrer to them in trauma, 90%, and we did this checking, 90% of our patients that we say to them have health insurance coverage when we send it to them. We're not dumping at all. And they do a great job with our patients. Thank you.
Representative Rick?
Well, I just want to thank you, Chairman, and I just wanted to, you mentioned the dumping, because I'm concerned about the dumping. And I'm from the Faribault Hospital, and I, too, have an award-winning hospital down there. Aware of a very, very, very good hospital. And I'm also talking with some of my constituents who don't bother to go there. They come up to Hennepin County more and more, carloads of them. And that's a reality. That is exactly what's happening. I consider that dumping in a roundabout way. So I too want to thank you and thank Representative Murphy and everyone here for bringing all of this together. It's very, very, very fractured, and we do have a lot on the table to deal with, and I hope that going forward we can address this. And I see where, you know, my Faribault Hospital is in trouble with the bill that is presented before us today, and we'll have to figure out how we can rectify that, I hope.
And just one other thing on this idea that hospitals are profiting on GAMC. You know, it's not clear to me that anybody's actually making money, just like the doctor said before. It's probably you can't make it up in volume. So I'm not sure that's an entirely fair characterization of what this proposal does necessarily. But I understand the inequity issues you're pointing out. But I think we need to kind of be careful about the language that we're using around these programs.
I can appreciate that. Thank you.
And I do see that one of your proposals is a broad-based tax on all providers, an increase in the provider tax. Is that?
Yes, to all providers.
Okay, and so that's something you're advocating for?
Yes.
Okay. All right, any other questions? Representative, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess not to the witness here, but just in general, I have a major concern on just one aspect of this, and this has to do with this spreadsheet here. And I appreciate you acknowledging the fact that we talked about those who would qualify for Minnesota Care. But what I'm wondering, and maybe this question should go to Representative Murphy, is would it be possible to see this spreadsheet with, I mean, pick a percentage, 50% of the people who qualify actually getting, and then the compensation coming to the hospital? Because everyone gravitates now towards this spreadsheet, because we can pick out a specific hospital or a specific city. So we should really be able to look at realistic numbers then. These aren't realistic at all, because the people will qualify for Minnesota Care right now. So if we're making interim decisions, we should be able to make it on realistic data. So I guess I would request that we would maybe see another spreadsheet with X percentage coverage.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly, I'm not quite sure what you mean by the 50% or X percent of coverage. So if you could explain that to me just a little bit more, that would help.
The idea, I think, is to update the spreadsheet so that Minnesota Care, the governance proposal, is actually acknowledged in that last column.
Correct.
And pick out, and you're acknowledging it's very difficult to figure that out, but just put in some number that adequately approaches that.
Absolutely, correct.
So, and that's the Hospital Association, not Representative Murphy.
Correct. Right, I understand that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, I think it would help us in kind of find the solution that that is going to best suit Minnesota. I haven't seen a lot of fiscal, I don't really understand the fiscal impact of the administration's proposal, other than I know it, you know, creates $160 million of deficit and takes the health care access fund into deficit next year. I know that it is
According to the commissioner, it covers about 28 million people, or 28,000 people of the 70,000 people that would be eligible over the year for general assistance medical care. And we know that they're only on there for a temporary time in the auto enrollment. But I haven't seen a fiscal rundown of that either. I think that would help us in our discussion.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
And Representative Murphy, that, I guess my point going back to the hospital association, because they freely admitted that they considered 0% coverage. So whatever would be acceptable to this committee, I would just say I think the hospital association would be the perfect one, since they put the spreadsheet together, to say, okay, we said maybe 50% or 75%, pick a number, but that would at least make these numbers more realistic to have this discussion with.
And Mr. Chair, on that point, I think because we have done a lot of work on this piece of legislation, and because, you know, we are hoping to move it through the legislature in a fashion that accounts for people's need to help shape it, but to get it to the governor before the program expires, we have worked quickly, and we've done more in this committee today on the finance side of the proposal than we might have in a policy committee on purpose, so that people can have a look. I think it's important that we just have a look. And so I will talk to the hospital association, and I'm also going to talk to the administration about that, because I think they need to give us some input in order to figure that out. And then I want to just say to you, welcome to the struggle.
All right. Well, I saw another Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we probably want to try to finish this, you know, in the next 5 minutes or so.
Since you referred, drew my attention by your comment to his actual proposals, it raised another question for me. In terms of, you responded to Chair Thiessen about the provider tax proposal, but if you could explain a little bit about, I understand the rebates to disadvantaged hospitals, but what's the caps on the tax payments? Which tax
on the Minnesota Care, and I don't believe that's a possibility to do under federal law, so that one I know has to come off.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you, thank you for coming, Mr. Stevens.
Well, Mr. Chair, if the hospital association is going to make those runs, maybe they should also tell us who we're going to have to kick off Minnesota Care when the fund goes bankrupt, and which working families and working individuals will be eliminated from the program.
And I'm not sure the hospital association can figure that out, but maybe somebody can. So, okay. Representative Abler has a couple of amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, these are, I'm going to offer these and then withdraw them, but I, not that I don't think they're good ideas, but I want to give the author a chance to look them over, and I'd like some input from the department and the public, and do you care which one you do first, Mr. Chair? I'll offer the A26 amendment, Mr.
Chair. The A26 amendment.
And I think that what we've gotten out of this hearing has been a lot of very productive commentaries, and I want to commend the author for her work. She's worked hard on this along with many interested parties, and I think today was solution focused and practical, and I think the solution we're going to come up with at the end will not be every word in this bill, and there'll be some more words added to it. I would just, if I were a gambling person, I would predict that, and I know the author's open to improvements. Part of the objection I've heard all along from the current law, by the way, and we're reminding everybody, current law is what exists if we don't come to an agreement with all three bodies, is that the people simply can't afford the $4 a month, and the co-pays are a burden. If I had a longer amendment, it would also include enrollment provisions. I want to remind members that Minnesota Care is a creation of us, and we can tweak it, we can modify it, we can make it easier, harder to get in, we can, with some limits, we can adjust the eligibility things, although there's some limits on that now. But so what this amendment does, it handles two of those concerns. And it says that if a client who's been in this group is enrolled in Minnesota Care, and if they're engaged in a meaningful relationship with a clinic, I just picked it four times a year as a meaningful time, and I asked the department for advice, and they're still getting back to me what meaningful might be, but I just picked four times a year as a placeholder. Then they would have their $4 copay waived, their premium waived, and then the $3 or whatever the copay is for services per visit also waived. It's my presumption, and I hope Mr. Hoffman is listening, wherever he hangs around, that if we get these folks engaged in a meaningful way with a clinic, they're going to go to the hospital less. And so that's something I think that would be productive, and that's the point of this. And I think another needed thing, if we get the time comes and there's no agreement on the key elements that drive the proposal we heard today, these kinds of provisions will make the world easier in the meantime for the people who need the service. And that's the amendment, and so I'll stand for questions about it.
Any questions?
And so an auxiliary version would include some other enrollment matters. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll withdraw this amendment. Okay. And I may offer it in the Finance Committee or at a later time. So, but I also wanted to give the Policy Committee the respect of having heard the idea, at least in a preliminary form. Mr. Chair, I'll offer the 827 amendment.
So the 827 amendment, Representative Ayler moves that.
Thanks. Different people have gotten their names attached to different versions of this bill, and there is no abler bill, thank goodness, maybe everybody would say. But I like the Hennepin County proposal in particular. And if I were going to adopt one, I would adopt their proposal because it shows some real grasp of the world about us. And they create these accountable care organizations. And especially with this population and the services that they get, there are definitely places where they congregate and where they don't congregate, and the people, the entities that serve them need help serving them because they're challenging in many ways, and high need and high mobility and anyway. And so what this says is this asks the department to come back with a plan, and I'll just be very direct. This is a placeholder. And as this bill goes forward, and to the doctor who was wondering about the hospital people, what they were wondering, there's a piece of paper tied to this bill. This piece of paper, along with whatever words you put together, moves around. It goes to a conference committee at the end. And as provisions that are relatively germane to the topic can come back from the conference committee and will be the bill. And so this is one you want to watch. This can change quite a bit along the way. But if there's some language about accountable care organizations, it might make sense to do something on the order of that. And the idea of an accountable care organization, I think, is a genius stroke, and I commend Hennepin County for thinking of it. Is that they get in my mind, it would be where they'd get a pot of money. They don't have to earn it. They just get the money. 20 million, 50 million, whatever millions related to that thing, they get a little less than they would have gotten or a lot less, depending on how the money works out. And then they're encouraged to be frugal. Under the fee-for-service model, which continues through the bill that's in front of us and through the model we have in this country, where we're driven by piecework and driven by the fee-for-service schedule, if you don't do stuff, you don't get paid. You don't get paid for keeping people well where they don't need stuff. You get paid for doing more things. And some of those things you just don't need. Some things actually kill the people that were going in to get helped. And so sometimes less things is better. And in this case, the hospitals and the groups that join together to be accountable care organizations would be rewarded for doing the right amount of care. Not too much, not too little. And so they would... there would be no incentive to do one extra scan or one extra surgery or one extra anything. And as the one hospital mentioned, they would put four or five people assigned to the group and they would actually just work on them. And they would get to know them. And so there would be great incentive for them to cost contain. If you start cutting rates, the incentive is just human nature. We'll do more things. We'll do a few more scans at a below market rate. We'll do a few more of these. And there'll be no containment in the cost. And the problem with all the fee-for-service stuff in Minnesota, particularly the ones that are driven without any oversight, which is the department fee for service and other ones that are just where they send a bill and get paid, is nobody asks, why did you do that? And nobody scrutinizes that. And so this way, the people on site at the hospital or group of hospitals, if it's Alina or whoever, or if it's Hennepin County, would be encouraging folks to like be frugal about the money. And so it's a long way to describe it, but it's actually a very complex but a really cool idea. And this would be, in my mind, would be for the hospital segment only. I think the good doctor made great points about the need to be able to see people in a patient setting at the clinic. I hope it, when the day is over, that the clinics can go forward with the same lousy rates they had before we did the bill. So that they'll still want to at least attempt to serve these folks. Because if they won't take them, they will be back at the ERs again, being charged rates, even at higher expected, the prices will go up more than we thought. And so I think there's somewhere to go with that. I think I had one more thought to offer, and I think I'm done. I have some points to the bill, but in terms of to this amendment, I think it's somewhere to go, and I'll work with the author, I'll work with Hennepin County, I'll work with whoever, but I think this, for this population in particular, maybe even the medical assistance population, the non-disabled MA population, as we look forward to $1.2 billion and a $5.4 billion budget, keeping our eyes on the prize of serving the people, not preserving an acronym or something, but the people who need our care in a very tight time, I think this will be somewhere to go. So I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
A testament to Representative Huntley's vision a couple of years ago, I have to say. But
I'm ready to burn this.
So
there we go.
we could have been there. I don't think there's any questions on that proposal. So
I'll withdraw that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Abler. To the bill. Any questions, discussion on the bill?
Representative Abler. Sir, I hate to be monopolizing the discussion, but this is an example of the quality of work we're going to have to do in the next 3 years to see the people we care about get the service. And I think as we dig in together, without regard to party, without regard to geography, without regard to anything, just how do we get the work done? This is what we got to do. And as this bill goes forward, I just want to remind people that there are three legs to this stool. And there's certain things that are going to be, I think, a problem as stuff goes along. I think this, the unallotment language in there is going to fly out like a red light to a certain person who resides in an office across the street from here. And I think as we work to get a bill passed, it, and I think I made my other points, so I'll just leave it at that. Thank you for your kindness in letting me speak, Mr. Chair.
President Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, Representative Murphy, I thank you for your work on this, and we do need bipartisan work. I think my only concern is I've heard comments as the bill is presented that in some form we want to get this through quickly and get it done, and other testifiers said this isn't a perfect bill, but it will have to do, and I flat out disagree with that, and I think there are a number of other people who do too. I think we owe it to the people we're trying to serve, not GAMC, because I personally think that GAMC, the stickers all say save GAMC, I think it needs to be reformed significantly so that it does a better job of serving the people it's trying to serve and does it in a sustainable way so we can keep the promise. So I hope that you and others will be open to lots of good ideas. There are some that other people have been working on. I know I've been working with a working group throughout the interim. I've presented some of those ideas to several provider groups. There are lots of good ideas, and what we need now, where the pain is so intense, is to get all those good ideas on the table and pick the best solution for the long term, not just for the short term. So I appreciate all the work you've done on this, but I really think we need to look for the best solution, not just a solution.
President Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I've overstayed my welcome here, and I appreciate this so much time in the committee. As I said in the beginning, and I'll say again, this is a work in progress. I would not represent this bill as the best and only solution. And I think the work bipartisanly has already begun, and I really appreciate the spirit of the committee members and their willingness to look at sort of the what is a less than beautiful proposal, wrestle with how to make it work better, with the goal of not just looking at our own parochial interests, but trying to figure out how to serve the population that we know is sick and poor to the best of our ability given the financial constraints we're facing. And I remain open to everyone's ideas, and I am very confident. I really am confident in our ability to solve this problem this session. So I'm looking forward to that. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And Representative Bunn.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I would have slipped in there. I didn't ask fast enough. Two questions I just want to lay on the table, not for you to answer now, but for you and the Hospital Association to think about and have some sort of answer for our next meeting. One is that since it's not entirely accurately known how much money would be collected with the surcharge, if I understand correctly, it depends on precisely? Okay. So in the bill, do you know exactly how much would be collected? It doesn't depend on the level of services of people who actually come in. She's answering me. Well, here's my question. So maybe it's moot. But I guess the question is if the surcharge, if what actually occurs is different than what was assumed in the bill, and in fact, if what actually occurs, you collected more money than you anticipated, would there be a redistribution back to the hospital? That's one question. And the second one is if amazingly the feds actually came through and there was a
federal MA money that might become available, and something like this had already been passed, would there be a mechanism for providing the money back to the hospital? So I just lay those on the table. It's kind of big picture issues for consideration and reflection on offline or in finance. Okay.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 2680 as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Dean. Oh, I will move the bill, I suppose. Yeah, I always think you're on our committee. So,
I was going to.
I thought I am too. So, yeah. Thank you. I'll move the House Bill 2736 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate this opportunity to present this bill today. I want to begin by thanking Representative Murphy for her work on this reform bill. I think we have very, very close and overlapping goals, which is to get the right care to the people at the right place at the right time. We realize that this is not always easy, and in this current economic climate that the state faces, it's very, very, very challenging. The governor has also said that he is open to any further proposals, and I know that Representative Murphy and I share the goal of being able to come up with a bill that addresses the problems that we face with this patient population in a way that the governor can sign, and it's something that we can all vote for. So that is something that we have worked together on, and my bill doesn't mean that I necessarily disagree with Representative Murphy's bill at all. I do, and I would like to continue to work with her on that. But what I wanted to do was to present another mechanism for moving, for taking care of these patients within Minnesota Care, as the governor has proposed. So this bill is different because this bill says, what if GAMC does go away and they do move into Minnesota Care? How do we deal with the very legitimate problems that the stakeholders have brought forward? And so that is what I am trying to deal with within this bill. Many, since the unallotment and the governor's announcement of this, several things have come forward with problems that would be have to be dealt with bringing these folks into Minnesota Care. Number one, that many of them, it's a very challenging population. They're mentally ill and chemically dependent, have a large proportion of folks who are mentally ill and chemically dependent. There are folks who are adverse to treatment, which makes them very difficult to treat and manage long term. They don't fill out their paperwork, all of them, so they have problems with re-enrollment. So if we don't have people re-enrolling, we have people who are not covered if they re-present at the emergency room in the back of a squad car or in an ambulance, as is often the case. So we wanted to deal with three things. We wanted to deal with retroactivity if these folks move into Minnesota Care. We want to make sure that they are cared for even if they have lapsed off of Minnesota Care. So we needed to provide a mechanism for that. Number two, we wanted to provide long-term care for these folks in a coordinated care model, because we believe that if a coordinated care model or a medical home model works for anyone, it would work best for this patient population that deals with social services, with housing, and with county services, and lots of different services, requiring lots of different services from mental health, chemical health, housing, a lot of supportive services that really these folks would benefit from a coordinated care model. And we want to do so in such a way that we can use funds outside of the Minnesota Care pool so that, you know, we don't draw that down quicker. Now let's get a really clear picture on how many people this is, because I always like to picture things in context.
So if we're looking at between 30 and 60,000 people, you know, throughout the state of Minnesota, that's like the number of people that would attend a good or a bad football game in the Metrodome. So that's the number of people that we're dealing with statewide. Not a huge amount of people. And I did a little bit of math, and it's about a little bit more than a 0.5% of the folks in Minnesota. So we're dealing with a very small percentage of people, but it's one that causes a lot of difficulties to a few number of hospitals. So how can we really focus on the problems that if we did move these into the Minnesota care system, and let's just say that that's an assumption that I took, how would we help these hospitals deal with the costs of that patient population? And the way that I did that was with the medical home model. So that's kind of the assumptions that I took with this, that the patients would move from general assistance medical care to Minnesota care, number one. Number two, that we would have to deal with retroactivity as they move across. And number three, that we have to deal with a long-term solution that brings down the overall cost of this patient population, because we cannot continue to grow at 30% biennium to biennium within this population. I think Senator Berglund agrees that we can't do that. I think Representative Murphy agrees that we can't do that. We all agree that we can't do that, so we have to bring the cost down, and that is the way that I propose that. Very, very quickly, Section 1 of the bill deals with the census that we're going to be doing. So if we look at this patient population, it assumes that if they move into Minnesota care, everybody in general assistance medical care goes into Minnesota care. Some of them will be able to exist and kind of work within the Minnesota care program as it is, and some can't because of the persistent chemical mental issues and other things. It would give the department a year to basically figure out what's the parameters, what's the census, who could deal within Minnesota care and who can't, and then to develop what I would call a general assistance Minnesota care program that would really focus on these people that need additional help and can't operate within Minnesota care, that would give them the extra help that they would need. And so that would, during the course of that time, it would basically, the department would divide the GAMC population into those two categories. In the time in between, it would assume that everybody moves over, everyone qualifies, is moving over, and would be covered retroactively if they were to lapse off. So we wanted to deal with that even during the time of the census and before this second portion of Minnesota care was created. So we wanted to deal with that in that time. And since the last committee hearing, I have submitted this to the department and been working with them on some issues that they have. And we have brought forward some changes within the bill that deal with the mechanics of moving people from one group to another, from GAMC to Minnesota care, how that happens, and then how we can actually make that retroactivity clause within this mechanism, how it would actually work, and that's what's dealt with in the Section 2 of the bill. So that's basically the changes that we've done from last time to this time within how people move across. The change within the medical home model, the county-based model, is in the last section, and the changes there is how do we make sure that people re-enroll? How do we make sure that they pay their premiums, even if it's $4 or $5? And the counties obviously know that they are going to have a role, and this would ask the counties to take the responsibility of premium and re-enrollment. It would be for the long-term medical home model, it would be county-based. It would be all in or all out, and the counties would basically assume the risk at the reimbursement rate for Minnesota care if they chose to do this. If they didn't, there would be, let's say they had very, very small GAMC population in their county, as many, many counties do, they would just simply pay for the Minnesota care portion of their, that they would pay the Minnesota care rate for those folks, and they would just continue to bill fee for service. So if it made sense for the county to do it, as some counties have put forward an idea that said it would make sense for them, they could do it, great. There's permissive language in the bill that would allow counties to band together if that made sense.
So if you had adjoining counties that wanted to do this together, that would make sense. The language doesn't prohibit that. And it would be a way to really concentrate the involvement on those counties that have the most patients. So Hennepin County may really want to do this. It may be better for them, and they may, I think, particularly with care coordination, save money in the long term because of the intensive county involvement in these people's lives and the density of where they live. It would make sense for some counties to do it, and it wouldn't make sense for other counties to do it. Now, Representative Thiessen has been very, very gracious in allowing me to put this forward without saying how much it costs or where the money comes from. Representative Huntley will not be so generous. And I know that. We are waiting for the numbers to come back from the department, and we realize that this is going to cost more money, the retroactivity piece, and really solving the problems is going to cost money. We're going to have to deal with that. We're going to have some revenue ideas on the table within the finance department when that comes, but I appreciate your indulgence and hearing me out and allowing me to move this along and a second track with Representative Murphy's plan, because I do think that we need a fallback position if the folks actually are migrated across into GMC. I think we would not be responsible if we didn't think about how that might happen and provide some solutions for doing so. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Any questions? So you're thinking of some of this coming out of the Healthcare Access Fund, but maybe some other revenue source as well to pay for some of it? Is that what you're... And I don't want to put you on the spot, but that...
We're looking at everything right now, and it would be my idea to present several ideas for revenue to fund this, more than what we need, because as we've seen, that's going to be a very contentious piece of this, and to make it fair... and also to find a solution. If we find a solution, we need one that the governor can sign, and I want to be able to work towards that end as well.
Yeah, Representative Abler.
Thank you, and I just want to commend the author for some good innovation here, given a lot of restraints on all this stuff. And I, between the two bills here and the amendments that I brought forward, I think you're getting at least a bit of a swirling effect. And I meant to bring this other piece forward on the previous bill, but actually it provides interesting stuff on this bill too. If I could just offer my
absolutely
my no amendment, but I have a piece of a document that I got from the department, and it's really interesting. And part of this, what I've gotten out today, is defining the problem. Not so much the people are at risk, we already knew that part, but how does it impact the hospitals, the rural hospitals, the big hospitals, and all that, and the different fixes that are proposed. We knew that part, but how does it impact the hospitals, the rural hospitals, the big hospitals, and all that, and the different fixes that are proposed. This is based, if you have this chart in front of you, it was passed out. Did everybody have it there? It's in your pile of stuff. This shows the actual fee-for-service payments made to hospitals in 2009. And if you recall, the people get enrolled in fee-for-service in GAMC for 6 weeks or so, and then they get shifted to a managed plan. The department didn't know how much that they spent on that part, which to me is like really surprising, because it's like in bazillions, I don't know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. I shouldn't be facetious, but it's like a lot of money that they, and I'm surprised they don't ask the plans to account back to us how they spent our money, which I think could be another bill, but that's not for this bill. But all I have here is the fee-for-service component, which many think might be the greater part of the cost on some of these folks. But anyway, so if you look at the last page on the totals column there, there was some $54 million paid to hospitals in 2009 for JMC hospital payments. And of those, the next column over says how much that was for under $10,000 per person. And the next column is what part exceeded $10,000 per person. And so this winds up being 14-some million that was paid over $10,000. So if there had been a cap, $14 million plus the $1,000 copay would have been not paid, maybe... what's my quick math here? About $19 million or something wouldn't have gotten paid to the hospitals, which is kind of interesting. But what that this $14 million is 26% of how much the hospitals got, And so as we work on a fix, we want to be sure we don't cause hospitals to lose more. And I think we've seen some of the rural hospitals don't do as well. But as just to keep in mind that if current law goes forward, this $39 million would be nominally available in the Minnesota Care pot to pay out, nonetheless that it bankrupts the fund and those little petty details. But in terms of the payment plans that are put forward, the hospitals that are nervous, never mind the bankrupting of the fund, but the hospitals that are nervous about their reimbursements might actually fare better under the current law in Minnesota Care. I also want to point out that Minnesota Care rates are higher in most cases than JAMC rates. And so this is just meant to be more information put forward. But I think given the way Representative Dean's bill reads in terms of current law, this actually becomes a good thing. And so see who loves you. I brought forward data. So anyway, that's just more advice to the committee.
Any further discussion? Representative Dean, anything further?
Well, I just want to, again, thank you for the opportunity and look forward to working with Representative Murphy on both these things, and hopefully we can find a solution. I actually am very confident that we can, and that we can work through this, and it will be a good first step. One thing that Representative Abler brought up was the benefit set. That's one of the things that I was most interested in, saying, you know, if we move the patient population into Minnesota Care, is it better, is it worse? And because that was an initial concern. And actually, the benefit sets, as I've looked at them and have heard back from some stakeholders, actually is comparable, in some cases better. And then the reimbursement I have not looked into. But I think that those are some issues that we can deal with. Obviously, it's the mechanics and then also the money that we need to work on moving forward. Look forward to working with everybody in the committee, and thank you for the opportunity and time again.
Okay. And I suppose is there anybody out there that wants to testify on this? Okay. I'll renew my motion then that House File 2736 be recommended pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, everyone. The next meeting's Tuesday. All right, we're adjourned.